Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you've missed any of my talk radio breakfast show, don't worry. We've put some of the punchiest bits of this morning's show into a bite-sized podcast, the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. Enjoy.
Talk radio. Julia Hartley Brewer at breakfast on Talk Radio.
Good morning, Julia. This is Talk Radio Breakfast with me, Julia Hartley Brewer. Thank you very much indeed for your company. Delighted to welcome the Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, to the show right now. Good morning, Chisa.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Well, lots of big announcements to the Prime Minister yesterday in terms of moving out of lockdown tier restrictions, still waiting to find out which tiers we're all in and what's happening over Christmas. But there's one specific major announcement, and that regarding the test to release. And this is allowing international travel once again. Can you explain how it's going to work?
Yeah, really simple. At the moment, if you travel from an area, a country which is not in the travel corridor, these are the things which change every week that can be difficult to predict, then at the moment you have to quarantine for 14 days when you get home. What this means now is that after 5 days, you'll be able to take an authorised private test. And in doing so, if it's negative, you can be released there and then.
And obviously, this is going to make a really big difference. People who've got family overseas, family and around. But a lot of people are wondering, well, how are we talking about this happening mid-December in terms of people travelling in and out of the country when large swathes of the country may well be in Tier 3, which tells us to avoid travelling out of Tier 3 and indeed in Tier 2 and Tier 1, telling you not to travel into Tier 3 either. So you're allowed to travel internationally, but not around your own country?
So essentially, if you are travelling in a way that's not going to sort of endanger other people, as it were, you can do that. Obviously, if you do then travel, when you get back, you're going to have to either quarantine for 14 days or have a test. So you won't be sort of further endangering the area in which you live. We do ask people to be sensible with it. And we are also asking people to check very carefully where you're going to, because oftentimes you'll find there are restrictions in the country or the region that you're going to the other end as well. So it's, you're right, it's not totally straightforward. You've got to think this through before you book and you go. But there aren't restrictions per se.
Okay, now people who are paying for getting these tests, they're going to pay for them themselves. It's not going to add an extra burden on the taxpayer. A lot of these tests offer more than £100. But we know that the cost of test and trace very quietly slipped out yesterday has now gone up from £12 billion to £22 billion. What on earth has that been spent on?
Yeah, I think we actually put some more money into it. So this is money projected to go forward. And look, we know that the best chances we have of defeating this virus are being able to, clamp it down by testing, knowing where it occurs, ensuring people self-isolate, or increasingly now looking at things like the lateral testing. And that's where some of this money will go to. Lateral testing is these very fast tests that give you, within 30 minutes, your reply. So people, holds out the hope that people will be able to go about their normal lives as long as they've taken a test in the morning. And then, of course, the really great news of the vaccines coming down the line as well. But we have to assume in the meantime, we need to do all these other things to keep things under control.
We have a lot of problems, though, with the rolling out of mass testing to allow people to have what is effectively a freedom pass to go about their daily business. Given that the vast majority of people do not have COVID and never have even at the peak, we're in a bizarre situation where we're going to be using tests, spending billions and billions and billions on tests that are on perfectly healthy people to find out that they are indeed perfectly healthy to go about their normal lives. Given the sums of money involved, why not? If we've got that sort of money grows on trees. It doesn't. Every single penny we spend on one thing is a penny we don't have to spend on other things, or it's extra tax, extra borrowing, that again, future spending. Is that really a good way to spend what is effectively the health budget? Would there not be much better ways of spending that money that would save far, far, far more lives?
One of the things we know about this disease is that, unfortunately, the reason it spreads so viciously is a lot of people who are asymptomatic, they don't know that they are carrying it around, are actually spreading it. So we do need to find out who those people are in order to stop the spread.
But actually, that has actually been debunked since. Even Fauci in the United States was clear about that earlier on in the year. And it's now a recent study published in Nature, peer-reviewed study in one of the world's renowned medical journals, after a study of 10 million people in China, has found that actually some pre-symptomatic people for a couple of days before they are actually come down with the virus can be transmitting the virus. But actually, asymptomatic transmission is virtually zero.
Well, I think we'd be...
I'm sorry to quote evidence. I know the government's not big on evidence, but...
Well, there's a little bit unfair. We do spend a huge amount of time with our chief medical officers and scientific advisors and sage.
How are those 4,000 deaths a day going, by the way?
And I should point out, Julia, that you'll always find one scientist who thinks this and another scientist who
No. This isn't thinking. So, this isn't opinion. I'm quoting a major international, a major study that's been published in a world-renowned peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Yeah, I think the point, simple point I make is, I don't think anyone would argue is that if we knew everybody who was COVID positive, albeit that you make the sensible point about a period when people might transmit before they know they've got it themselves. But if you did know everybody and you were able to self-isolate those people, of course we would be in a much better position. In fact, we know that's how to deal with it. So the cost of not dealing with COVID, I would suggest, is so much higher.
No one is suggesting not dealing with COVID. No one's suggesting, as the Prime Minister suggested, let me try
it in a different way, actually. Let's look at the Liverpool example, where it will have been, I think it's fair to say, a combination of different things. They've had a strict tier three lockdown before going into the main lockdown. But they've also had mass testing, and there's some evidence that these lateral flow tests have really helped, that it's helping to identify people and that's helping to keep a lid on the disease. So I think very good example in Liverpool. Let's see what happens as we expand that program.
Except infection rates were already going down in Liverpool even before they went into tier three and even before this testing started again. I'm sorry to throw evidence at you. I know this is not popular these days, but those are simple facts.
I love looking at the evidence. It's absolutely what we should be doing. But I don't think anyone can argue that having a mass test program, we can already do 538,000 tests capacity a day, and being able to double that up again, which is our plan before even the lateral flow test, I don't think anyone can say that's a bad thing. If nothing else, we'll be able to use it to test for other diseases domestically in the future, rather than having to
something of a concern people are worried. Let me ask you, we're talking about this with Ian Duncan Smith, who worked in government for many years, of course, as Work and Pension Secretary, and he was very, very clear that whenever there's any major decision in government, particularly when it costs billions and billions of pounds and has major effects, there is always a cost-benefit analysis carried out. There is always an impact assessment, but it's required by the Treasury if there's a huge cost. What do you think this policy will achieve? What will be the cost? What will be the benefits? Mark Harper, a Tory MP, one of your colleagues on the back bench, has asked the Prime Minister yesterday for what was the impact of each measure in each tier on COVID and the impact of each measure in each tier in terms of on people's lives and on businesses. Are you aware of that cost-benefit analysis, and is the government going to publish it before the vote in the House of Commons on these tier restrictions next week?
Yeah, one of the reasons we've made the tier restriction vote next week is it will be after a huge data dump of a lot of analysis, which will take place tomorrow as part of the spending review. So actually all of that work's been worked up in government over the last few weeks with the spending review. The information will be out there and people will be able to come, MPs will be able to come to their own assessment on it before the House of Commons decides
There'll be clear evidence of what each, so closing the pubs at 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. That will be the expected effect on COVID will be known, and the expected loss of life and loss of the economic effects, that will be known, will it?
I totally understand the desire for complete clarity, but I have to tell you that a lot of these measures cross over. So you will find that one measure and another measure, and I just gave you example in the example in Liverpool. What happens in those areas is that it may be that it was a severe tier three lockdown, it may be it was happening before, it may be that the mass tests were involved. You can't put an exact number to each of those things, but we are getting better at understanding the things that really help, which is why we're better at dealing with this now than we were at the beginning.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
I'm delighted to welcome my first guest this morning. I bet he's glad he's not in charge this year. As former Health Secretary, Lord Andrew Lansley. Good morning to you.
Good morning,
Julia.
Good morning.
No one would want that job this year. That is certainly the case, isn't it?
But I have to tell you, Julia, it's quite a tough job. Anytime.
Do you know what? My father was special advisor to the Health Secretary, Lord Ennals, David Ennals as he was, in the 1970s. Oh, yeah. So I'm in the Labour Party. So I know this well, but there we are. Let's talk about what is happening right now. Now, lots of new announcements in terms of testing, new announcements about new tiers. We don't yet know what the plan is for Christmas. Could find out today or tomorrow. We don't yet know which part of the country is going to be in which tier, and that has a massive effect on businesses. We don't even know actually what the criteria specifically are going to be. Was it first of all, do you think it was the right thing for the government to announce that we are going to have these different tiers before saying which part of the country was going into which and before saying what was going to happen over Christmas, given that Christmas Eve is exactly a month away now?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's a tough one. The government said they were going to go back into a tiered system after the national lockdown to December the 2nd. So having said that previously, I think it was probably incumbent on them to say, well, what does this tiered system look like? And at least how many tiers are we talking about and what are the characteristics of those tiers? Because remember, there are some differences. So, for example, working from home is a recommendation in relation to tier one, which it wasn't in the past. So there are some changes in the tiered system. But it is quite awkward for people, you know, to know that they're going into a tiered system, but not to know which tier they're in. And it's especially difficult for businesses. I do completely acknowledge that. But, you know, Julia, I think probably it's better to focus on what we know rather than what we don't know. And you made the point about, well, you know, back in the spring, you know, the Prime Minister was talking about 3 months and so on. Well, to be perfectly
honest,
three weeks. Oh, don't get me started. It's you know, that was...
Well, this is the thing. People are talking about being out. Look, you and I both knew it was going to be more than 3 weeks. It was never going to happen. I also knew that we were never going to be out of our four-week lockdown. I mean, tier three is a lockdown in all but name, apart from being able to go to the hairdresser, for goodness sake. These things, there's no such thing as a circuit breaker. None of this stuff is ever going to come off. But the news that we do know for a fact this is going to happen until Easter at the earliest. A lot of this is going to be down to how quickly a vaccine can be rolled out, isn't it? And that's one of the issues, because only a couple of weeks ago we had Matt Hancock talking about how we could roll out, you know, once we knew about the Pfizer vaccine, we could roll out vaccine for all the people who really needed it, the elderly and the vulnerable. And we're looking at something like probably 12 million people or so, but we could roll that out by Easter. And then last week there was talk about rolling out a vaccine within a few months major project, but rolling out within a couple of months vaccines for everybody, the entire 67 million people of this country. And now we're back to, from the Prime Minister yesterday, talking about the majority of those who need it getting it by Easter. These are three completely different aims involving completely different effects on the rest of the country. Which do you think, having been in charge of the Health Department, which do you think is the most likely?
Well, they're trying to do something which is unprecedented because it is much larger in scale than the flu vaccination programme in the autumn, which was probably vaccinating about 10 to 15 million people over the space of 10 to 15 weeks. So your starting point is a million a week. Well, that's not good enough. We've got to do much better than that. We've got to potentially vaccinate the whole population with two doses. So you're looking at something like 130 million vaccinations. So that's an incredibly large logistical exercise. But I suppose in a way, Julia, you know, you're as much of an expert on this as anybody, because it's actually about our psychology in the circumstances where we know that there is a vaccine in prospect, but there is a really rather difficult and potentially dangerous period of time. Because remember, it's midwinter, It's when these respiratory conditions tend to be more, they're more virulent and dangerous. We really don't want January and February to be a period where a vaccine is an immediate prospect, but we haven't yet vaccinated some of the more vulnerable people by on grounds of age or chronic conditions. We've really got to, either we've got to get that the vaccinations to them even faster, or I think more realistically, maintain quite a strict social distancing and indeed not mixing households over the period running up to that, which brings, but you know, Christmas is really tricky because if households mix across generations on a large scale, January will be very difficult.
But hold on a minute. We know that January is going to be very difficult anyway, because we know every single year January and February are difficult. We know that deaths go up every winter. Respiratory deaths in particular go up every winter. There will be COVID deaths going up this January through December, January and February, because COVID is the dominant respiratory disease. And let's face it, we all know also know that anybody who's dying of something else, vaguely respiratory related, or even to heart disease or something else, if they test positive for COVID and it's endemic in hospitals, they're going to be put down as a COVID death. So we know that those figures are going to look bad. What we don't want is mass hysteria from the populace and indeed from the healthcare workers and the government about something that we know is perfectly normal. We are yet again in a situation where we have right now no more than, there's nothing abnormal about the deaths we are currently seeing, even before the point where the lockdown could possibly have an effect. We're at the top end of the normal range of deaths that you would get in a normal year from normal diseases. And in fact, it's large thought that actually a lot of the excess deaths we are seeing are not COVID. They're people not being treated for other things. We do need to get this in perspective. So when we see that rising death toll in December and January, people shouldn't be sort of running around going, ah, help, we need to lock down again. That's going to happen and it'll happen no matter what we do.
No, nobody's suggesting hysteria, are they? And the statistics, I'm afraid you have to accept that they're very substantial increase in deaths earlier in 2020 will have in part meant that people who would have died later in 2020 died at an earlier stage because they had some serious chronic conditions and they were the most vulnerable. The fact that our level of deaths going into the winter is more nearly a normal level is actually rather disappointing, because we might have hoped that we would see a lower rate of mortality in the later part of the year. But that's, leave that on one side. Point is this, we know that the bulk of the problem occurs in the mixing of households. We know that what people are hoping for, but I think probably realistically should avoid, is mixing households across generations over Christmas.
At home,
and
that's
into
crucial.
The new year. At home, absolutely. And I am immensely sympathetic to people's wishes, but also I'm very sympathetic to businesses of various kinds, because frankly, I think these businesses will not survive if we don't allow them to open. And they are, many of them, in fact, overwhelmingly, putting an enormous effort into being COVID secure. And people are probably more secure there with their families than if they were mixing at home.
Yeah.
And certainly with their staying overnight with each other at home. So I think we ought to be, I don't know precisely what the restrictions the government are going to put in are, and social bubbling for three households sounds to me still to be quite potentially risky. But I think people ought to be prepared to accept quite strict conditions on themselves if the government won't do it. Impose restrictions on themselves in order to protect older people, vulnerable people,
but again,
for 3 months.
This is the thing. I don't know anybody who's got elderly relatives or relatives who are facing sort of particular health risks who hasn't done that. And the point is that people are good, kind, sensible people, vast majority,
yes.
People who would obey the law anyway, the sort of people who would do those things anyway. You don't necessarily need to have those restrictions in law imposed on us by a government, you know, by decree.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Let's go through some of the actual restrictions that we are looking at in terms of different tiers, because it's pretty complicated stuff. Basically, if you are in tier one, this is we're going to do really, really basic, simple stuff. It's going to be medium alert. So tier one is now kind of where we were in last time around, called medium alert, but it's the lowest level. Basically, you have to follow rule of six if you're meeting indoors or outdoors. Pubs and restaurants will shut at 11, although last orders at 10. People are encouraged to minimise travel. We're still working from home if possible. There will be live performances and sports events with spectators allowed, although very, very limited numbers. And you're also allowed things like personal care, like hairdressers. So tier two, which is pretty much where most of the country we think will end up be. That's high alert. No household mixing indoors. So forget the rule of six. No household mixing indoors at all. The rule of six will apply outdoors still. Pubs and restaurants again to shut at 11. Alcohol only served as part of a substantial meal. So an awful lot of ordinary pubs that don't serve meals are unable to stay open. There will, of course, be sports events and live performances. Again, limited numbers. And again, you can still go to the hairdressers. Now, again, still allowed to go to the hairdresser in tier three. That's a very high alert. But no household mixing indoors or outdoors, at home, in your private garden, in a hospitality venue. That's it. None of it at all. Outdoor public spaces, there is a rule of six applying. Again, I'm not sure how much we're going to be doing that in December and January. Pubs and restaurants closed entirely except for delivery and takeaway. So very similar to lockdown measures. Indoor entertainment venues closed and guidance against travelling in and out of the area. So, I mean, really, to all intents and purposes, tier three, other than non-essential shops being open and being able to go to the hairdresser, remarkably similar to lockdown. Tier two is where I think most of us are going to be. Well, this is unless or until we get enough people having the vaccine. Now, the new Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is the one that is giving us all so much more hope than the others. Pfizer gave us all that hope, 95% efficacy. However, a vaccine that does require being stored at a minus 70 degrees Celsius, so needing effectively dry ice, puts huge extra costs on it and huge extra difficulty. The Moderna vaccine from America, huge price, £28 a dose in the region of, whereas we're looking at the new Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, 90% efficacy and just costing a couple of pounds, well, £3 a dose. Well, let's talk about why this vaccine may be the best hope with Dr. Penny Ward, who's visiting professor in pharmaceutical medicine at King's College London and chair of the Education and Standards Committee of the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Medicine. Good morning, Penny.
Good morning.
I mean, I think we are allowed a cheer and a sigh of relief and indeed some pride, I think, at this vaccine, that one of these vaccines has been developed by one of our own universities and a company here in the UK. There is such significance to a vaccine being easily transportable and being cheap. Even if it's got slightly lower effectiveness than the other vaccines, isn't it?
Certainly. And in terms of our normal vaccine supply line is refrigerated shipment, which this vaccine is. So that would make life a lot easier for people distributing and administering the vaccine using the usual supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, and this is the key thing, isn't it? I mean, having sort of minus 70 degree flasks of dry ice is a rather complicated and expensive logistical nightmare, isn't it? Whereas this vaccine seems much more different. Why would one vaccine cost £3 and why would one vaccine cost £28 and why would one need to be refrigerated at such low temperatures or frozen and why would one just need normal refrigeration? What's the key difference there?
So the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, the messenger RNA vaccines, and this is a new technology, and messenger RNA is relatively unstable. So in order to prevent it breaking up and not being useful, it has to be stored at very deep freeze temperatures where biological activity is stopped. That doesn't mean that it's, because obviously it's not given when it's frozen, so it can be taken out of the freezer and stored for a limited period of time over which the companies have generated the stability data to show that the vaccine is still stable. And different companies do that differently, and that's why different periods of time are on the label, as it were, for being right. able to store.
And this is the sort of stuff that would have been seen, overseen by the regulatory authorities on sort of, they've been looking at rolling safety data. They don't do this, carry out the research and then appear and go, here's all the information, now start looking at it. That because of the need for the speed on this, one of the reasons why these vaccines are going to be rolled out so much more quickly than we would ever normally see it, is that they've been looking at all of the safety and all of the tests, testing results.
That's right.
Pretty much in real time.
Yeah, in real time. And of course, it's not just the research that had to be completed, but also the scaling up of the manufacturing process. So if we thought the research was tough and difficult, then I can tell you that manufacturing millions of doses of vaccine is a heck of a lot more difficult still. And those processes can only really get going as and when the vaccine shows that it's effective, first at producing an immune response, and then secondly at showing that it prevents disease.
So when do they start that process then? Because they didn't just say, hey, we've got an idea for a vaccine, let's try and test this, and then they start manufacturing it there. And then do they wait and see the early stages of trials, and as soon as they've got something they're pretty sure about, then they start that manufacturing?
So manufacturing is a staged process. Normally it starts with the scientist producing something on their desk, actually, in the lab, and then it gradually gets into bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger bioreactors. So if you go past a field where you can see the grain silos sitting in the field, then that's the size of a biomanufacturing process unit that's used for manufacturing for the marketplace, where millions of doses are required, as opposed to giving it to a few tens of thousands in a clinical study, where a much smaller bioreactor can be used.
Now, there are people who, there are people who are anti-vaxxers, who don't want to take vaccines that have been around for decades and have been taken by hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, like MMR and the like, who refuse to accept all the evidence that these things are safe. Those people, I think, are probably lost causes in terms of getting them to take vaccine. But there are also a lot of other people who had all the vaccines themselves, given vaccines to their children, don't really think twice about it, who are worried about vaccines that have been developed in a matter of months as opposed to vaccines that have taken years and have been able to look at long-term health effects and the like. What would you say to those people about whether or not they should take this vaccine and whether they should trust that it's safe?
Well, firstly, the total time spent in studying this vaccine is actually the same as would have been done for a normal vaccine, which apparently takes much longer. And that's because under normal circumstances, you have to raise money more slowly to do the research. It takes much longer to persuade people that the disease you're treating is important enough to need vaccination of a population, and to be able to complete the clinical studies with diseases that may have a very low frequency in the population in general. So ironically, even though it seems like a very short period of time, in fact, all the steps have been covered exactly as they would have been for the usual childhood vaccinations, for example, but they've been compressed into a much shorter time period because of the greater urgency of needing a vaccination to control this very difficult disease.
And what about the idea that there will be long-term health risks associated with the vaccine that we haven't, even if a vaccine went onto the market, someone would say, well, yeah, but I know that vaccine's been used for 20 years and people don't get side effects or anything, but they won't be able to see the long-term effects of it this time around. What would you say about that?
Well, I think that we've got several hundreds of years of vaccine experience, actually, with a variety of different technologies. And we know that for the vast, vast majority of people have absolutely no problem in the longer term with having vaccination against a dangerous disease. And the balance of the risk of dying or having a serious problem because of the disease significantly outweighs the minuscule risk from a serious long-term problem related to the vaccine. In addition, of course, we do have vaccine compensation schemes for the very rare circumstance in which an individual is damaged by the vaccine itself. So in those circumstances, those individuals can be assisted to carry on their lives.
But those are tiny. I mean, we are
talking
minuscule numbers.
But they're tiny fractions. We're talking less than 1 in a million people.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening to the Julia Hartley Brewer Daily. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe and give me a good review. And don't forget to catch me on the Talk Radio Breakfast Show every weekday from 6:30 until 10.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.